Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode is a real treat, an absolute treat. It was very nice to sit down with the legend that is Brian Slagle, the CEO of Metal Blade Records, with his new book, Swing of the Blade, coming out on May the 8th. What a treat it was, filled with a whole bunch of wisdom, funny stories and anecdotes. He was everything that you want Brian to be, and hugely important person within the metal community and the metal scene. And it's always, you know, when you get to talk to people who you aspire to and influence you and are your heroes, you always hope that they live up to your expectations. Brian surpassed those expectations, talking about how, you know, the beginnings of Metal Blade and how difficult it was, and some of the situations he was in, the trials and tribulations of getting metal to a broader audience, and then throughout his career, sort of the challenges that he's faced, and then ultimately what the future looks like and bands that he likes to see do well now. And he still talks passionately about metal. He still talks passionately about the scene and working with bands, and he's still full of energy and life for the scene. And we can only hope that we all have that feeling about the scene, about music, where when you get to, he's over 60 now. It was absolutely superb. And he talks about the scene with welcoming with open arms, people who are coming into it to be promoters, reviewers, bookers, agents, managers, everything that isn't the musician themselves. He talks about that and how it there's a wide open path for you, ladies and gentlemen, that you wonder how you get into this scene and how you get into this genre and how you get into this business. And he gives you those steps, and Uncle Brian welcomes you, as we say. If you want to be a part of the scene and part of this business, there is room for you. It's not crowded. There is room for good people. And there's also a room for people within the scene already and bands to work with each other, to work together, to create that community and that family. And he talks about that as well. We talk about hockey, we talk about not metal and things to do to take your mind off it. We talk about everything in between. In many ways, for me, this is one of those landmark episodes. This is a very important episode, I feel, for myself, just to go to the next level of who we talk to and the conversations we have. It was wonderful to speak to one of my heroes. It was wonderful to get his really human, really positive, really genuine and interesting and funny at times, very, very funny feedback as well. And it's just wonderful. It was a wonderful thing. So, ladies and gentlemen, please sit back and enjoy my conversation with Brian Slagle, the CEO of Metal Blade Records. Ladies and gentlemen, it's always a great pleasure to speak to people within the business, but if there is someone that personifies defending the faith, it is this guest I have before me today. Ladies and gentlemen, the CEO and founder of Metal Blade, Mr. Brian Slagle. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Where do we start? We're going to get to the book, obviously. I spent the weekend flying through the book, because every page I was like, what is the next piece of information? What is the next story? There's clearly going to be more books. You must have had a ball reminiscing a little bit when you were going through the book.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I never thought about really writing a book, but when it kind of came around for our 35th anniversary, which is now 6 years ago, scary. Just to do the history of Metal Blade, and that was fun to do, because, you know, you had to go back and kind of relive things which you don't really ever think about or do on any basis, really. So that was kind of fun to do. And then, you know, luckily the response was so great and people wanted more stories and more stories, you know, longer stories about the bands and more stuff about obscure bands. So yeah, it was kind of fun to go back and you know, kind of remember a lot of that stuff and, you know, tell as many stories as I can. And it was fun, but it's weird because I finished the book prior to the pandemic. So it's kind of been sitting around. We did do a little bit of an update just because we felt we had to say something about it, because we couldn't just put out a book without anything. But then it got delayed furthermore because of a paper shortage due to the pandemic. So So finally, it's seen the light of day several years later.
And so it's only when you, 41 years of Metal Blaze, you are part of metal history, sir. You are part of that now in the same way Cliff Burton is, in the same way that all these bands that we adore from large to small, you are part of that history, sir. You know, and, you know, Kerry King does the introduction. You know, did you think when you're watching Slayer opening for Bitch in 83 that you'd be like, okay, this guy's going to write the foreword to a 40-plus year record label?
Yeah, no, of course. none of us back then thought anything was ever going to happen with anything. We were just a bunch of young kids and, you know, just loved the music and wanted to do whatever we could to do the music. Funny story about Kerry. So Kerry's one of my really good friends. We have Raider tickets together and, you know, we hang out as much as we can, even though he's now in New York and I'm still here in Vegas. But I was really nervous about asking him about it. And I didn't really want to ask him directly. So I actually went to management and asked them if he would do it. Cause you know, he doesn't really do those sort of things. And I found it kind of felt weird asking, but he agreed to do it and he did a phenomenal job. So thank you so much to him.
That must have been interesting when you got the email back going, yeah, Kerry's wrote it. And you thought, what's he wrote? What exactly is he wrote? You know, that must have been an interesting moment.
Well, he had sent it to me. I'm trying to remember because, like, I didn't get an email for some reason. So he texted me the whole pretty long text.
Sure.
I was like, is this okay? Is it this all right? I go, it's amazing. Are you kidding me? Of course it's okay. So it was fun.
One of the things that reading the book that is, and listeners as well, you'll get this as well when you come to read the book, as I strongly recommend you do, is how many sort of close calls and bands didn't make it or didn't break through or fell by the wayside. And there was so many, you know, early on you talk about Armored Saint and kind of like, you know, to most metalheads, that'll be a familiar name. We'll know albums, certainly, you know, Symbol of Salvation and stuff. We'll know these albums, but newer people to the genre probably wouldn't know these bands. And it just seemed like how close they got to being, you know, breakthrough acts and stuff, and just didn't work out for them. And there was loads. There was so many.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's realistically in the music business, you know, you've got to, it's not just about being a great band or putting out a great record. You've got to have a whole team surrounding you. Management, lawyers, agents, record label, everybody's got to be on the same page. I equate it to a car. If you have four tires on a car, if all four tires are going in the same direction, the car's going to go very fast. If one of them's not, then the car's not going to go anywhere. And that's kind of the way it is for a lot of these bands. And you know, specifically for Armored Saint, and, you know, Fate's Warning kind of falls into this category as well. They put out absolutely, in my opinion, incredible records in 1991. Both of, you know, ended it up in, you know, various magazines and Metal Hall of Fames and all these sort of things, looking back on what great records they were. But they came out in 1991, which is when Nirvana and everything completely derailed the whole metal scene. I firmly believe, and I think I talk about this in the book, that if those records came out in 1989, they might have been huge. Mm. But all that being said, you know, this is not necessarily a sprint. And if one of those two records had become, you know, let's say Armored Saint, if they had a gold record and became huge, who knows what could have happened to the band, if they would still be making music now. And, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? So they're still together. They're still making music. They are still surviving, making music and having fun and doing great tours. And, you know, I don't know if all that might have happened had they been successful. You can't rewrite history. It is what it is. But yeah, there's a lot of that, a lot of those, so many bands that got so close and never quite.
You have the privilege though of being in the business for as long as you have, that you can see some of the journeys as well. I think about, you know, the second concert you ever went to was like Y&T supporting Boston. And then you get to see like 1990, 1991, you get to release works with them. That must be fantastic. You were right, Brian. They would have a career and it would be great. You were right.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's always a complete honor to work with bands that I grew up being a fan of, and I've been lucky enough to do that so many times over the years. You know, whether it's releasing, you know, Thin Lizzy, Alice Cooper, Deep Purple albums, or, you know, doing that Y&T record, and we've done a bunch of stuff with them. And I mean, look, I'm predominantly very lucky in the fact that whatever I seem to like, other people seem to like. So that's, you know, kind of the way it's worked for me, is just whatever musical taste I have, it seems like everybody else, or a lot of other people, not everyone, of course, a lot of people have a similar taste. And that's kind of, you know, got me through all of these years, probably.
So humble, sir. So humble. But you have the magic ears, as I've often told people. When I was growing up, a Metal Blade record was a stamp of quality. Okay, they're on Metal Blade, or it was like maybe it was Roadrunner, all those sort of labels. They were signs of quality. Someone has picked this and they have stamped it that it is good to go. How important was the time you spent at Oz Records then? Because that put you in contact with people. This was pre-internet, obviously. This put you in contact with people. People would come through the doors and you could talk enthusiastically about music. How important was that?
Well, yeah, hugely important, obviously. And that's, you know, realistically why I started record labels, just to help bands and help people find bands. And being in the record store was great because you had the one-on-one with people come in and say, hey, you know, somebody would come in and buy like, you know, Black Sabbath record. Hey, have you heard Iron Maiden? They go, no. I go, oh, listen to this. And then, you know, just turning people on to new music was really fun because I love the music. I figure if I like it this much or love it this much, maybe other people will. And certainly that was, you know, step number one. And also the fanzine, you know, doing that prior to that, just, you know, being able to connect with other people that had similar interests. Because honestly, before that, and I talk about it more probably in the first book about the, you know, the whole Metallica story, but, you know, just was Lars, my friend John Carnarens, and I were the only three people in LA who knew anything about what was going on in England. And we thought we were just the only three people in the US that knew anything about it. But there were other people, obviously, in other cities that had similar tastes. It was kind of fun, first with the fanzine, and then, of course, with the record store, being able to actually meet these people and see that there were like-minded people that were into the same things that I was.
Yeah, isn't it interesting as well that, you know, you're now based in Vegas and you have an actual bricks and mortar store there now? It's almost, isn't that wonderful that that's kind of come around?
Well, yeah, and it's really easy because it's part of this really cool, it's the Antique Mall of America is the name of it. It's just this big antique mall, but you could, and there's a couple other record shops in there as well. You just set up a store in this place and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to be there. You just have to replenish it. You know, they take it out. So it's kind of the dream come true because I always wanted to have a shop again, but overhead and finding employees and all these sort of stuff is just, you know, I have a busy enough life as it is, let alone trying to do that. So this is kind of the perfect scenario where it's there and people can go check it out and we don't really have to, like I said, other than making sure we have plenty of stuff in there, we don't really have to do a whole lot of work.
I thought it was a wonderful kind of like, bookend to that whole situation. The other thing I found really fascinating was your relationship with Warner Brothers, and you know that first sort of when you go in, I assume, and you'll have to help me out here, Brian. Was there a room you went into to kind of look at the artists that they currently weren't having anything on the slate for, or because it was pre-internet, they couldn't send you here's a list. What happened there? How did that work?
Well, yeah. So basically, you know, when we aligned with a major label, in this case, Warner Brothers, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was, and this is, you know, again, early 1990, CDs were all the rage, but, you know, the labels just did not have, especially the major labels, just did not have the wherewithal to release everything that they could. So part of the deal that we put into our thing with Warner Brothers, like anything you haven't put out at this point that's hard rock or heavy metal, we want to be able to have the rights to do. So I knew all the records that weren't out, trust me, you know, and the Warner stuff was, you know, 3 Alice Cooper records, 3 Deep Purple records, and 5 Thin Lizzy records. And so we wrote that in. Then they also gave me the keys to their vault, which was crazy because I got to go in there and, you know, get all the tapes out. And I found these two Alice Cooper live shows from Dallas and Houston in 1973, Billion Dollar Babies tour. So I'm like on 2-inch reels. So I'm checking these out. I took them to the studio. Bill Metoyer and I listened to them and kind of, you know, did a little mix and they sounded incredible. And I was like, oh my God, this is like the best find ever. So I went to Alice's management who were good friends of mine. And, you know, they helped a lot with the 3 records that we put out. They said, hey, we should do something with this. This stuff is really great. And they go, yeah, Alice isn't really a big fan of the, I guess that was Billion Dollar Babies when they're all kind of messed up. And he's like, yeah, I wasn't really a fan of it. But as a fan myself, I thought it was amazing. But thankfully, later on, they did use a lot of it with when they reissued Billion Dollar Babies on CD. I don't know when it was, mid late 90s or something. They did use a lot of that stuff. So I was pretty happy about that. But yeah, that was super fun. And also, another quick story about that. I can't remember if I talk about this in the book or not, but with the Thin Lizzy stuff, like Thin Lizzy is one of my favorite bands. As you can see Phil hanging out over here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember if it was Jim Fitzpatrick did that. But anyway, so we had to go to Philomena and the people that had the rights to the Thin Lizzy stuff. And they initially were not in agreement to let us do it because they were standing behind so much money than Warner Brothers. They're like, well, we're not going to make any money, so what's in it for us? And Warner Brothers at the time, and it was a lot of money, they said, we'll rescind all of this and we'll pay you guys from Record One from the reissues, which was really amazing for them to do and enabled us to be able to put out all those great records, which, again, as a fan, was just a dream.
You didn't necessarily invent it, but certainly you pioneered the re-release and put the extra tracks on and things like that. I mean, even coloured vinyl and things like that. You were one of the first sort of people doing it. You obviously, coming from a fan point of view, I want to hear these unreleased tracks or these unreleased live cuts or whatever it may be. I'm populating a really nice presentation, a really nice sort of presented package. And that was something that I don't think anybody else was doing, certainly not to the level you were doing.
I mean, you know, the labels were doing a fairly decent job of when they, you know, were reissuing CDs about trying to do something interesting with them, and same thing with the vinyl. And, you know, everybody that works at Metal Blade are all fans. So we all are huge fans, and, you know, the staff does a really great job at, you know, reissuing stuff and, you know, different colors and different variants and different packaging. We always try when we're doing any of this stuff to get whatever we can to put out. But there's a real difficult scenario with that because, like, there's live stuff from every band. There's some decent quality live stuff from every band. But not every band wants to release that. So they go, oh, I don't really like the way it sounds or the way I played. And, you know, I get it from the musician's point of view, but also from a fan point of view. We don't care. We just want that really great stuff. So, I grew up.
It reminds me of bands. There's a very famous Van Halen demo at the county fairgrounds, and it's not very, you'll know this, but it's not very well recorded, but it's a snapshot of that particular time, and Eddie's playing exactly at that time and Roth's voice at that time. It's a real interesting sort of almost a museum piece of snapshot, you know, and it's not the sound's awful, but that's not really why you just like, look how fantastic this thing is as a curio, you know, and it's nice to see that. Like, I wonder, Brian, how many, because we're just talking about Warner Brothers, there were several other key sort of major labels have lost stuff, you know, and stuff's been kind of lost now because no one was curating it. Like, there was someone like yourself doing that in other labels that wasn't going on. So you wonder how much stuff got lost and fell by the wayside, you know, to shame.
Yeah, there probably is. I mean, there's a lot of things that would be nice, but just for an example, in addition to all the other bands that we put out in the early 90s, you know, one of my favorite bands from the 70s, and I grew up in the 70s, so a product of that, all that rock and metal stuff, was Angel. I loved that band, and at that time, their product wasn't out, so I actually had meetings with all the different guys, Frank Domino, who now lives in Vegas, by the way, Punky Meadows, all these different factions, and, you know, trying to get, you know, reissue the stuff, trying to put extra stuff out there. And eventually, it was kind of funny, eventually the labels kind of figured out, well, if Metal Blade wants to do it, why shouldn't we just do it? So all the stuff eventually came out, which is, as a fan, all I really wanted to. But they all told me that they're somewhere, it might be erased at this point, but there's a full-on live show from Angel, move like 8 cameras, a whole professionally photographed show. No one knows where it is. We did a bunch of digging. The closest thing we can figure out is that, you know, whatever company was that had funded it, it got bankrupt, and who knows where the tapes went. But a lot of us feel that the tapes just went somewhere where they're just like, oh, we'll just re-record over this stuff and put something else on it, which is a shame because, you know, they were a really cool live band. It would be amazing. There's hardly any footage out there.
One of the things that, you know, the digital age has given us, because previously they would record over tapes and stuff like that, so they wouldn't have to buy more, and they would store them poorly because it cost too much, so things would damage and wouldn't last and deteriorate and stuff and what have you. But now that isn't the case. You know, that's one of the advantages of the digital era as well. And I mean, the other advantage now is that, you know, there's this Metal Blade playlists, there's Brian Slagle playlists, just so you know, Brian, where people can go and listen to an extremely obscure, you know, Cryptic Slaughter track or something, you know, and that's got to be, you know, that's going to be fantastic for a fan like yourself, that you can start people off on the journey. Here's a really well-presented remaster, but now go and check out all their back catalogue, which is, you know, an absolute treasure trove of stuff.
Yeah, and like I said, that's the real big positive of the digital age. And it kind of all started, you know, back in the file sharing days, more or less. But, you know, access to music now, everybody has access to music. If you want to listen to something, there's a million different ways you can go for free and listen to something and get into it. And I think that's one of the big reasons why metal and many other genres of music become so popular, is because access to music is so much easier. Back in my day, in the olden days, you know, you had to buy the record, take it home and listen to it, and it may be good, it may not be good. And you're, you know, you've paid your $20, whatever it was. So now it's so much easier and better. And I think that's so much far superior for just the business, the health of the business in general, because you can hear anything. And like I said, you can go back and listen to old stuff. I remember in the early 2000s, a lot of those, you know, metalcore bands were coming up, and they were curious about the history, like, you know, curious about Thin Lizzy or Rainbow. I remember one of the guys asked me, hey, can you put together a CD of, like, you know, classic Rainbow stuff for me? I'm like, sure, of course. So I made a CD, and, you know, now you can just say, go wherever, and you listen to it now.
It's interesting you talk about metalcore, because there seems to be several points in the history of Metal Blade and yourself where a new sort of element of metal is introduced, and you kind of have a relationship with it and then keep going. So, like, you know, before we get to metalcore, I'm thinking about more death metal. And you're really honest in the book about, you know, the first time you hear death metal, you bump against it. It's like, okay, it's not really where I've come from. It's not Noabim. It's not that type of thing. There's an aggressiveness to it. And initially, you know, a little bit reticent to kind of get involved with that. And it was fascinating to see that eventually you completely going all the way into it and falling in love with it, in someone like Chris Barnes and Cannibal Corpse, and you putting your arms around it. And it was so refreshing to see someone, you know, who was deeply ingrained with one style in the genre to take the time and really try and get into another genre as well. I found that incredibly interesting.
Yeah, but look, I'm a fan of everything, and I want to give everything its due, right? But I'm the first to admit I was not on the ground floor of the death metal scene. You know, Earache and Relapse and, you know, Roadrunner and all those labels were well into it far before I was. But I heard it. You know, I heard what they were doing, and I heard this stuff coming out, and I just thought it was fascinating, because realistically, what was happening was music was getting heavier and heavier and heavier, but the vocals weren't. The vocals were just the vocals. And that's kind of where death metal really came in. So let's make the vocals as heavy as the music. I was like, well, that's a really interesting concept. And, you know, I liked it, but it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't like a radical fan of it necessarily in the beginning, but I learned to really appreciate what they were doing. And there's melody even in, you know, the vocals. And then, you know, talking to the vocalists is really interesting about, you know, how they do it and how they write things and how they, and the whole thing was really fascinating. And then, you know, we got lucky in a sense where, you know, we had a lot of connections in Buffalo, New York, and we got a demo tape from a band called Cannibal Corpse from Buffalo, New York. And literally I looked at the cassette and there's a song called A Skull Full of Maggots. And Mike Failey, who works at Metal Blade, from Buffalo, was the one that brought me the tape. And I said, before I even listened to it, I said, let's sign this band. I don't even care what they sound like. They have a song called A Skull Full of Maggots. Let's just do it. And then, of course, the tape was actually pretty good. And away we went.
There's a lot of that, though, Brian. We got quite lucky. You didn't. You got the magic ears. Because then you get to see them go all the way to breaking through, if you will, with Tomb of the Mutilated. You get to see that. And that must be like, you know, this... That must be, I keep saying this, but it must be incredibly rewarding to see that, to see you and then go and see them play in front of people and go, I think people are getting it now. I think people feel the way I do about this. That must be rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the best thing about the job that I do here is, you know, finding a band, putting them out and seeing them have success, seeing them have a career, you know, seeing them be able to survive off of music. And that's really what it's all about. It's great. And we've been lucky enough, you know, I hate to keep saying lucky, but we are lucky enough that we've, you know, dealt with a lot of great bands over the years. We have a lot of bands who have spent their entire career or almost all their entire career with us. And that's really satisfying because that means, you know, they've all become very dear friends of mine too. So, which is important, but it just, you know, it just makes you feel good that that's what I want, what I'm here to really do. Not only to put out music, but also to have people have a livelihood out of it too.
You've talked about in the book here, some of the quotes from it, that you wanted simply a band to have a nice life, you know, a nice house and car and things and, you know, and a nice life. And, you know, I don't know if every sort of CEO thinks that way. In fact, I'm pretty sure a lot of them don't, you know, and that's probably why you are friends with these people as well, that, you know, that someone from a band will call you up and go, you know, what do you think of this? You know, and actually ask your opinion and be ready to hear it as well. You know, be ready to, for you to go, yes, no. And I think it's one of those powerful stories is Gwar, I thought, throughout the book. I talked to a few people in Gwar and about when we had them on because we covered the documentary. And that was, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story and your part within that story, you know, essentially taking a stand and having a falling out per se with Warner Brothers was, I thought, was incredibly a powerful story for me. You know, what was that like to make that stand? Did it seem at the time as important as it was? Because it was.
Well, yeah, it was interesting. So basically what had happened was, you know, we did that deal with Warner Brothers, as I mentioned earlier. And when we got there, Warner Brothers was an independent label, as were a lot of the major labels at the time. And it was run by Moos and Lenny Warnker, two of the most legendary people ever in the music business. And I have a great respect for both of them. But about, you know, I can't remember the exact time, but about 2 or 3 years into the deal, a company called Time Warner Inc., which, you know, owned Time Magazine and all this stuff, they bought Warner Brothers and became this big corporate entity. And the first thing they had was with Ice-T's Body Count's Cop Killer song, where all of a sudden it's a big problem. And, you know, I remember, I actually, it's funny, the first time I ever met Ice was at a convention somewhere, and he comes up to me, he goes, I need to talk to you. I'm like, this is not a guy I want to make mad, right? But we talked, and he was a huge fan of metal and just a really good guy. And, you know, the Cop Killer thing came out, and that kind of spawned Warner Brothers to all of a sudden, out of the blue, I get a call from, I wasn't even somebody that we dealt with on a day-to-day basis, and said, hey, we need you to come in. We need to talk to you about this Gwar record. All right. So I go in, and sitting in front of a few lawyers and also our product manager at the time. And they're like, yeah. So this song has to come off. These lyrics have to be changed. I'm sitting there going, wait, what? What is happening here? And they were saying all these things. And I think in the meeting, I'm just like, okay, let me think about this. But I'm inside incredibly angry because it's like, what is this? Like, I'm not ever going to tell a band what they can write, what they can't write. It's art. Art is art. And it's not up to me or a lawyer or anybody else to decide what art is. It's up to the artists themselves to decide what art is and whether that goes all the way. And look, I grew up in the 70s where Kiss and Alice Cooper were, you know, pushing the envelope. So I like to push the envelope as well. But anyway, it got to the point where I was like, I went to Mo and Lenny, and I was 20, I'm trying to remember now when that was. Probably like 31 years old, still young guy, still wearing cutoff shirts everywhere, corporate land, no suits. But I went to Mo and Lenny and I said, like, look, if this is the way this is going to be, I can't be here anymore because I'm not going to tell a band what they can and cannot say. I'm not going to take any songs off the record. I'm not going to change anything. This is who we are. This is what we do. And they were incredibly amazing and said, we agree. We don't like this any more than you do, but this is kind of where it's at now. And if you guys want to leave, you can leave. So basically we worked out a deal where, you know, the Goo Goo Dolls, which, you know, became a huge thing, stayed with them. And we took everything else and went to my friend, Brian Turner's label called Priority Records, which at that point was a, you know, had a lot of rap artists, and they clearly were okay with whatever lyrics. And we ended up putting out records with them for a while, and it went from there. But it wasn't, I wasn't thinking that I was taking a stand. I wasn't doing it for anything other than what I thought was right. And I think artists, again, should say what they want to say, and Gwar should be able to do whatever they want to do. And again, you know, we, I guess time has vindicated all of us maybe a little bit that we did the right thing. And, you know, Gwar is a legend.
Yeah. Like you say, it's not necessarily taking a stand, but it's at least sticking to what you believe. You know, like you say, you believe, you know, art should be treated in that way. It shouldn't be designed in a boardroom. It should be, you know, by artists for artists. And so, but that type of thing carries an enormous amount of weight. And then we move, I'm jumping around a little, but we move into like the metalcore sort of era. And that's when you see another form of metal, another turn of the cycle, so to speak, and you get metalcore. And you were talking about how that there was an incredible family and a team mentality, like on a bill, that bands weren't fighting against each other. We're like, let's make this the best show we could get. And you, that was something that you felt harked back to the early days in the 70s and the early 80s of metal. And I thought that it was interesting that you immediately latched onto that, you know, that that was a really powerful thing to have and almost start another section of the scene.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting looking back, and it's now, gosh, you know, 20 some odd years since the early 2000s, right? And I've really kind of become more, I guess, aware, I guess, of really how important that scene was. Because you got to remember, you know, the 90s, metal was almost dead. Some people said it was dead. I didn't believe that. A lot of people didn't, but some people said it was dead. So here we come to this new scene in the early 2000s, where all of a sudden you have this mixture of hardcore. And I've always been a big hardcore fan too, and punk rock and all that sort of stuff. But you have a mixture of these hardcore stuff with like classic metal. And all of a sudden it just breathed new life into the scene. And not just musically, but as I mentioned, just behind the scenes, because the hardcore attitude is all for one, we're all in it together, we want everybody to do well. And not only did we get a bunch of bands who were rooting for each other, which honestly, the metal scene wasn't quite that way. It was very competitive. You know, there was a lot of stories about, you know, headliners not treating opening bands very well, and very competitive and very much, you know, mine, and, you know, which is what it is. And not everybody, but there was that deal in metal. But here was the complete opposite of that, where everybody's just in it for each other. And more importantly, what we got out of that scene for the business part of it, great managers, great agents, great lawyers, all the things that I talked about earlier, where you need four wheels on the car, right? These people existed in that world that are all young, and they're all coming in with this fresh new attitude, and everybody knows everybody, and everybody likes everybody, and everybody's rooting for bands that they don't work with to be successful or helping. And that really galvanized the whole metal scene. And that's when everything, you know, the old bands got bigger again, and just the whole scene kind of turned around. And realistically, I mean, I don't know that you can underestimate the importance of that scene just on the entire genre of metal. Because would Iron Maiden be as big as they are now? Would Metallica be as big as they are now? I don't know. I get the feeling that maybe not. And one other quick thing too is, although those bands were also very, very open about their influences and who they liked growing up, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, learning about the Thin Lizzy's and the Rainbows, and then when they got into it, they would, you know, wear the shirts and talk about it in magazines, and that got all those kids that had never heard of these bands before into those acts as well. So it was a huge moment for metal.
I never, until you said it then, I never considered that, you know, that those, the people that were listening to the records in the early 70s, late 80s, and the metal that was going on there, well, they would grow up to be 20 and 30-year-olds, and some of them would go into bands and produce music like that and off the back of that, but also they would go and become a lawyer, or would go and become, you know, someone who presses records or someone who designs it. Of course they would. And then what's happening now is that kind of feeds it again. So although it's cyclical, it is moving forward. The wheels on the car, it is moving forward, isn't it? I think metal took the best things from hardcore and punk, didn't it? It took the speed and the vibe and the intensity and the no bullshit and no frills. And it took that, and it also took that DIY attitude, making your own t-shirts and your own merch and getting in a van and fucking driving around the world and stuff. And it can't, we took all those best things, didn't we? But I think you're right. I think that the people that weren't in bands also took the best things about it, about not ripping off the artists and looking out for people and, you know, looking out for the well-being of people in the scene, you know. And it's only when you put it like that that it had a massively positive effect, you know, where they can go, okay, well, we listened to all these great bands, but it also influenced a lot of what you don't see musically. It's interesting, yeah. Never considered.
Yeah, look, there's still a lot of people in this business that don't do it the right way. But that influx definitely was a huge help.
Yeah, and it's needed that, you know, you get to start to see, you know, you were there for the beginning of a band like Slipknot, you know, that you see take and go and become something. And then most recently, and you talk about this in the book, again, super honestly, about Ghost, you know, and your experience with Ghost, I found, like, fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Ladies and gentlemen, when you come to read the book, Brian is there is all the tea spilt, all the cards are out to sea. He will tell you exactly how it is, that's why I couldn't stop reading it. And you were really honest about Ghost. Was there a point you were talking about almost being done with the business because of how things went down? Is that true, Brian?
Well, it just, you know, look, my attitude, and, you know, and I've been doing this a long time, and I, you know, we've had a lot of bands that started with us that we lose them, and it's fine. I get it. And look, all I want for an artist is for them to be successful, and Ghost has become incredibly successful. And I had a really wonderful moment about 4 months ago at this event in LA, and Tobias was there, and, you know, we had a nice 15-20 minute chat about stuff. And, you know, I was thankful to him about how well they've done and the fact that they're taking a lot of Martha out on the road with them this summer, which is great, and vice versa. But yeah, it was just difficult because, you know, I mean, nobody had heard of that band. Nobody knew what it was. It was just a side project for a bunch of Swedish, you know, black and death metal guys, right? Yeah. But I heard it and just went, oh my, this is game changer. Game changer. What they're doing here is so great. And I worked really, really, really hard to help them get where they were. But again, I mean, looking back on it, I mean, at the time I was frustrated, but I get it. And it was just one of those crazy times where, I mean, we couldn't compete. Like, you had two major labels that were offering crazy money to these guys who at that point hadn't sold a whole lot of records. I mean, they saw what I saw, which was something pretty special there, obviously. But yeah, it got frustrating. It was just a little frustrating for me because I did so much work to really help get that entity to where it was. And yeah, for a minute, it just gets frustrating where it's like, man, I thought we could compete with the majors, because we kind of can. You know, we've got bands like Amon Amarth that have gold records in Germany, and, you know, a lot of bands that sell a lot of records. So we kind of feel like we have this little place where we have major distribution. We're distributed by Sony, but we have a very safe haven, as we like to call it, as a label. And so we thought we could compete. But yeah, when it gets like that, we can't compete. And that was just frustrating for a minute. But in the long run, you know, I couldn't be happier for the success. And they're, again, with the right people, their management, you know, Rick Sales and Kristen are amazing. And the agents, everybody that works for them is great. So I'm happy for the whole team. And, you know, just like anything else, just like with Metallica, it's like, you know, I played my little role in it, and it is what it is. And I'm happy that's where it is. But for a minute, it was
I suppose, Brian, it's a gift and it's a curse, isn't it? Because in order for you to promote this band, you have to believe in them. In order to work with this band, you have to like them. You have to understand them. You have to get on with them. There has to be things. But then ultimately, you're playing a game where if it works out well, you have to let them go to school one day and wave them off and hope that they remember. You know,
100%. No, you're 100% right. But like I said, I think it was more frustrated with the fact that we had kind of cultivated, you know, Metal Blade over all these years to be able to be, you know, we're not a major label at all. We're not owned by anybody or anything like that. But we do feel that we can compete on certain levels with them. And at that point, we just couldn't. But reality sets in. So it's all good.
So one of the things that I know you are asked a lot, and you talk about in the book, is, you know, bands that come to you wanting advice about, you know, what should we do with this and what should we do with that. And there's lots of stuff in the book that I would suggest people check out, and especially bands who are looking at how do we get signed on Metal Blade is probably the most asked question you ever get. But you pretty succinctly answer it by saying that, you know, you're looking for something different. You know, you are always searching for that thing that doesn't sound like the thing before. And I thought that was, although incredibly simple, incredibly powerful as well, that, you know, to do something different, to take a genre that's existed for a long, long time now, since the early 70s, if you want to, you know, maybe even predate Sabbath, and, you know, you're looking at Blue Cheer and Bazinga, take something like that and add your own, sprinkle your own thing to it. And that's a tough thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we just talked about Ghost, and, you know, when Ghost came along, they were doing something that nobody else was doing. Nobody else was doing that kind of classic, you know, traditional metal stuff, but tweaked so it doesn't sound like it's super dated, right? And ultimately, that's anything that's successful in music comes along because they're offering something different. I mean, look, there's a lot of bands that'll come along after whatever, and they sound similar to them, and they'll have a lot of success. And, you know, I'm not saying that we only sign bands that sound different, but I do think that a couple of things, and I talk about a lot of this in the book, a couple of things with bands that they need to know is, number one, somebody in the band needs to be a business person, because what a lot of bands think is that they work for us or they work for the management. No. We work for the bands. Labels, managers, agents, we all work for the bands. They don't work for us. Completely opposite. So somebody in the band has to be the business person. And it's that way in every band that's successful, you know, whether it's Lars and Metallica or Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones or whoever it is, there's always one guy in the band that kind of handles the business and knows about the business. So you can't just be a musician. You've got to have some guy in the band's got to know what's going on to protect yourselves. And then the other thing, yeah, you just, you know, it's okay to use your influences, but don't sound like your influences. Like there's 1,000 bands that sound like Cannibal Corpse or Killswitch Engage, whatever it is. Don't sound like them, but, you know, take those influences and put something that you guys as a band think is cool, not what anybody else thinks, but what you guys in the band think is cool. And if you can do something a little bit different, that's generally what's going to get you where you want to be.
Yeah. I think as well that one of the things you talk about as you kind of go through a timeline within the book, and you go to different cities, and you talk about the scenes there and falling in love with certain cities, Phoenix being one of them. And obviously now you're based in Vegas. And it's interesting how that kind of plays, a city kind of plays a part in a scene as well, and how they look after their artists. You know, I think of Texas and, you know, before even South by Southwest and things like that happened, the stuff that they were doing for artists. And I found that absolutely fascinating. And, you know, it makes complete sense then for you to end up in Vegas, you know, not a million miles from where probably Vinny, God bless him, lived as well, you know. And that's where everybody that comes through Vegas, everybody plays. Last time I was in Vegas, there was like 5 or 6 metal bands on any one night. I was like, this is fucking brilliant. You know, so it's interesting how much a city seemed to play a part in the music as well.
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, if I wasn't living in LA, we wouldn't be talking here in 1980, 81, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting how, but it's so different now, though, because while that's the case, and look, I love living here. I live here because, number one, I like the hot weather. It's finally here, by the way. We've been freezing. But, you know, so it's a really cool community. It's entertainment based. There's a lot of musicians live here, a lot of entertainment people here. It's very much like a small town. Everybody knows everybody, everybody gets along. That being said, there's no good new metal bands. There's a lot of metal bands here, a lot of new metal bands. But, you know, nothing quite there yet. I think there's some potential, but yeah, but now it's so different because of the internet and just the way the business is in general. And look, how does a band like Whitechapel come out of Knoxville, Tennessee? I mean, nobody's hanging around Knoxville, Tennessee going to see bands, but, you know, they created something there where, you know, agents and managers, you know, who work in that town started saying, hey, there's this band that's really good. And then they reached out to all the labels, and that's kind of how you find things these days more so than ever before. But it's still, you know, being in a city where things are happening still can be something. I mean, talking about a country like Sweden, I don't know why, but I don't know the percentage, but so clearly there's more metal bands from Sweden than there are from any other country. So, you know, we have a lot of them as well. It just is what it is.
I think you can. There's probably an element where you can get another Seattle and another, you know, San Francisco and type of thing, where there is a scene that's slightly localized. It's just changed a bit how people discover them now, I think, because of the net. And it's interesting you talk about Eamon Amarth and and how you approached the release of work by them, and how you looked at the structure of social media and how to present that to people, and how, you know, one tour they go out in just jeans and t-shirt type of thing, and how you didn't. And I found it absolute, ladies and gentlemen, you will find this fascinating too. Throughout the book, there are these little dabs of where Brian's put his fingerprints on something, and it's the critical decision to the band moving to the next stage in their career. And it's that deft touch that I found the most impressive. And Eamon and Martha are a really good example of that, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, they're, number one, you know, incredibly talented guys. I'm going to see Johan actually, I think this weekend he's got a big birthday coming up. So I'm going to go down and hang out with him, not in Sweden, in a much warmer climate, thankfully. A lot of these bands, you know, Cannibal Corpse is another example. I mean, you know, I can go on and on, but, you know, they're really easy to work with. You know, they become your friends, but they're really easy to work with, and they get it. You know, we're all on the same page. Everybody's on the same page about, you know, what directions they should go, what they should be doing, you know, all those sort of things. And really, my role is really not very, I mean, I don't create any of the music or anything like that. I don't tell bands, let me tell you about it. I don't tell them, hey, sound like this, sound like that. I just listen to stuff that they send me and say, yeah, that's good. And, you know, all that's good. And it's, with a band like that, it's really easy. I keep waiting for them to deliver a record that's not really great, and they just keep not doing that, which is awesome. But it's it's been great to see the rise, and, you know, to go on a bigger level. It's like people ask, well, you know, where's the state of metal? Like, where are the headliners coming from? Yada yada. Well, I mean, look, the headliners are getting there. You've got Amon Amarth, you've got Ghost, you've got Volbeat, you've got Lamb of God, you've got Mastodon, you've got Gojira. Like, all of these bands are starting to play large venues now. I mean, Gojira, you know, Amon Amarth sold out the Forum in LA. Gojira and Mastodon just sold it out about a week ago. And, you know, these bands are moving up the rungs, but you've still got the Maidens and the Metallicas and everybody else kind of up on the top. And, you know, I do think that once those bands, you know, retire, which we don't ever want them to, but time is what time is, you know, you've got all these other bands that are already kind of there that are going to become the next, that are already the next ones. And then you've got the ones coming up behind them too. So I think we're in really good shape with metal right now. I feel there's so many good young bands that I'm hearing that I'm really excited about, that I probably haven't been this excited in years for the next crop of stuff coming up. So it's good.
So if I'm listening to this now and I want to form my own label, and or I want to manage, or I want to help bands in a similar way to you, I feel like, I say, the book's incredibly inspirational, Brian. I came away from it thinking I'm not doing a fuck enough. my checklist of job list increased the minute I finished the book. Is what's your advice to those people listening to the teenager or the young person that's listening to this now and going, well, actually, that, well, I love what he does. You know, I'd like to do that for my small local scene.
Sure. I mean, look, number one, do it for the love of it. Do it because you love the music and because you love to do it. Because this is not an easy industry. It's not an industry where you're going to make a lot of money. Certainly not in the beginning. You know, you've got to do it for the love of the music. And luckily, those are, you know, 98% or whatever of the people in this business do it because of that. And that's why it's great. You know, I have talked to people in other industries and they complain about, you know, this and that. It's like, wow, you know, we really don't have a lot of that, those similar problems here, because we're all fans. You know, we're all, everybody, no matter who's in the business, we're all fans of the music. And that's one thing, you know, we can, people always ask, like, oh, you know, you're competing with all these other labels. Like, no, we're not. They're all friends of mine and we hang out. I mean, in theory, we compete, sure. But we're also all in it for the betterment of the music. And look, if, you know, if Nuclear Blast or Central Media or, you know, Relapse or whoever it is doing well, that's great for the scene, because that means the whole scene is doing well. And I hope, and there's, you know, there's definitely a lot of young people out there starting labels, and I think that's great. And the cool thing now is you can do it kind of like what I did. You can be a one-man show for a while and start something out. And there's a lot of good younger people doing it too. And so that makes me hopeful for the future. Cause, you know, I can't do this forever. I mean, I wish I could, but, that's just not reality, unfortunately. There's a lot of good stuff coming up, but I think the scene's pretty healthy. So there's plenty of ways to go in. You know, if you can play music, then you can be the band. If you can't, or if that doesn't work out and you want to be whatever else, just, you know, learn. And just learn. And a lot of it is just learning on trial by fire. You know, if you want to get into the business, start as a roadie. Like, you know, learn how to tune a guitar and go out with your friends and kind of learn how that works. And then you just kind of go from there. Because if you go on a tour with a band, if you're a roadie and you have your eyes and ears open, you'll see how everything works. You'll see how the labels interact with the bands, the managers interact with the artists, the agents react with the venues. You know, you'll learn. So there's plenty of ways to learn. But and I hope more and more really good people get involved in this business, because we need it. And that's the other thing real quickly, is there's a huge void for young agents, managers, all that sort of stuff. There's a huge need for that right now. So come on in.
But Uncle Brian says coming in, it's all good, we can do it, folks. Just as a wrap up here, now let's talk about something you maybe don't get asked as much. Your love of sports, and you talk about how it's a way of switching off, because you're an exceptionally busy gentleman, and you know, sometimes it's nice to put the phone down and watch your sports. It was something that I used to talk to Uncle Vinny about, you know, I am a Raiders fan and he was a Cowboys fan, but you were, are you a fan of the Kings? Is that right?
Well, I'm weird. I'm a fan of sports, and, you know, I grew up in LA, and unlike a lot of other places in the world, like, if my team's not doing well or not doing things the right way, then I don't have to like them. And that's been the way it's been a lot with the Kings over the years. Although it's the way it is with the Golden Knights now. You know, when I moved to Vegas, and one of the reasons I came here is I knew they were getting a hockey team. I'm not going to live in a city where there's no live hockey. I don't go to Australia in the winter time here to enjoy their weather, because there's no hockey there. But even with the Golden Knights, you know, I've had season tickets from day one, and I've been a supporter. And they kind of, although they're starting to do better this year, they've made some weird things. So I just like the sport. I like the sport. Sports being played at a high level, and I'm obviously, hockey is my number one. I'm a massive NFL football fan. I used to be a big Bronco fan. I still kind of am, but same thing, they're owned by the people who own Walmart. I'm not sure that I can like that. And I have Raiders tickets, because Carrie and I share Raider tickets, and I've become friends with a bunch of people who work for the Raiders, who are huge metal guys. So
I was gonna say, because, like, yeah, you know Hell's Bells and stuff gets played, and there must be a part of you, Brian, that when they play the metal, when they play Crazy Train, stuff like that, there must be a part of you inside smiles a lot, where you're like, yeah, that's everybody singing along, but they're all guys, you know.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot of guys who music at the hockey games who are big metalheads who I'm friends with, who when I go to games will play Amon Amarth and all sorts of crazy stuff at, you know, 18,000 seat arena. So yeah, it's great. I like it when my worlds collide too, because, you know, I'm a massive hockey fan. And, you know, I've done some work with the NHL and some other stuff. I had a podcast for 3 years that I did with Sean Rourke from NHL.com called Metal Misconduct, where we interviewed athletes and other celebrities about their love of metal, which was super fun.
Brian, just far be it for me to interrupt you, but that was one of the reasons I started my podcast, to talk to people within the world of that, crew members and TMs and stuff like that, but also to talk to people who were metal fans who were, no one would think they were metal fans. That podcast was one of the reasons I started to, sorry to interrupt, but you needed to know that.
Oh, awesome. That's great. Yeah, I mean, look, they're everywhere. You know, every industry, there's metalhead somewhere in it. As a sports fan, I always like to get in. Like, I'm a huge IndyCar fan. And for a while, I didn't know anybody inside. I said, got to be somebody. And one day, I see on Megadeth's Facebook page, they were at the Indianapolis 500 practice day in one of my favorite drivers' crew thing. I was like, what? How did this happen? So this is when Sean Drover was in the band, and I knew Sean pretty well. So I texted him, like, dude, how did this happen? He goes, oh, this is a photographer, you know? So I reached out to the photographer. Next thing you know, I'm in Fontana, California, in the box of Juan Pablo Montoya, because his crew chief is a huge metal guy. So yeah, they're everywhere. And it's fun to talk to them. And real quickly on the podcast, so Sean came to me and said, hey, would you want to do this? And I go, it sounds like a lot of fun, but athletes are the worst interviews. Like, how are we going to get them to talk for more than 15 minutes, let alone 45 minutes to an hour? But when you talk to them about something they love, like music, I mean, there's a lot of guys that, you know, we did multiple shows with because we could talk for 4 hours, which blew me away because, you know, everybody sees athletes and they're all taught to, you know, not say anything.
Yeah, but get them on the favorite metal album and that's it, isn't it? Yeah, they go and go. But it's, as a wrap up here now, looking at the future and looking at the next sort of things, is there a band you're maybe that people haven't heard of yet, like a slightly older band that you're going to be doing some re-releases for coming up? And is there a newer band that people haven't heard of that you think maybe they should check out? Your words will carry an awful lot of kudos.
Well, we're always doing a lot of reissues and we always talk to, you know, even other labels about it. We've had a great relationship with Warner Brothers of all things about, you know, we've reissued on vinyl pretty much the entire Roadrunner catalog, you know, all the way from Type 1 Negative to the Deicide and Obituary. And, you know, that's always super fun. And we're still working on a bunch of cool stuff like that. But we also have all of our stuff to do. We're reissuing a bunch of the really great 90s Merciful Fate and King Diamond records, which, if you haven't listened to them, please go listen to them. Really, really good records, and you might be missing out. There's a lot of new bands that are coming up that I'm super excited about. I hate to single out two or three because there's a lot, but if, you know, shameless plug, go to metalblade.com and you'll check out a lot of good stuff. But there's a band called Entheos that's out on the road right now that's really good with Whitechapel. And there's another band called Capra that's really cool. They're on the road doing some dates with Killswitch. Two really cool new up-and-coming bands. But the one I'm probably most excited about is a band called 200 Stab Wounds. We just signed them recently. Young kids. Look, I'm an old guy. I've seen a million shows. I don't get excited by much. But I went to see them at Psycho Fest, which is the big festival here in Vegas last summer. Merciful Fate headlined and throw a whole bunch of it. But anyway, I saw 200 Stab Wounds. I was absolutely blown away by how incredible these guys are, and we're really excited for them. Their upside is huge. I mean, it's early, they're young kids, you never know how it's all going to go, but as the corporate sports world of upside, the upside is huge. So we're really excited about them. They're in doing a new record for us now. There's a bunch of stuff out, you guys can check it out, and definitely check out some of their live stuff, because live they are really super intense.
That's honestly, Brian, to see you talk with such vigor and so enthusiasm about both the old and the new, it's wonderful, sir. And I'm sure the people listening to this will feel that as well. I can't thank you enough for coming on my tiny little show. I really, really appreciate it. The book is fantastic. I'm going to pass this around to everybody, to get everybody to buy this book, because there is a lot of wisdom in this. There's a lot of comedy, but in between that, there's also a lot of wisdom. And thank you again for coming on the show. I cannot thank you enough, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, the quite wonderful Brian Slagle.
Thanks, man. It was super fun. Thanks for having me.
How amazing is that, ladies and gentlemen? Did you enjoy that? I mean, you could tell when I'm talking to Brian just how, you know, just how happy I am just to sit under the learn tree with him and listen to some of the amazing stories and the wonderful pieces of advice that he throws out. His book, Swing of the Blade, out on May the 8th. It absolutely is an essential read. Even his book before that, For the Sake of Heaviness, is also essential. These people that create stuff and do amazing things within our scene must be, you know, you must listen to what they're saying and learn from their experiences and learn from their advice as well. Brian was absolutely an absolute sweetheart, and even after the podcast had finished, gave me some really wonderful pieces of advice and was nothing but an absolute gentleman. And it was just great to, you know, hear some wonderful stories. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope if you are a promoter, or if you're a booker, or you want to get into that field, or if you want to be a record label, or if you want to help with bands or whatever, I hope that what you got from that conversation was that it is totally possible, and it is a world you can get involved in. It is something that you should, if you're passionate about, make your life's work. Metal is my life. It has been very, very good to me, and it's something that is intrinsically a part of me. It is clearly an intrinsic part of Brian as well. How nice was that conversation? And maybe get Brian on the show again, because he'll write more books with more great information and it's just wonderful. One of the greatest things as well, we talked about off pod. We just talked about bands for a bit. He just told me some bands that he thinks I should check out. I told him some bands that I think he should check out. And it was just like two metalheads just talking and sharing great bands that he should check out. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Isn't that amazing? So yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I really tried hard to get the best people on the show that I think you'll get the most from. And Brian was absolutely top of the mountain stuff. And I really hope you enjoyed that. As always, thanks for listening. And I'll see you at the show.